From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins in for Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Attorney General Jeff Sessions says that even though President Trump just criticized him in the New York Times, he's still on the job for now.
I have the honor of serving as Attorney General. It's something that goes beyond any thought I would have ever had for myself. We love this job. We love this department. And I plan to continue to do so as long as that is appropriate.
As a comments from Jeff Sessions today, President Trump told The Times that he never would have hired Sessions had he known that Sessions would eventually recuse himself from the FBI's investigation of Trump campaign ties to Russia. Today marks 6 months in office for Donald Trump, and it's a day when Washington is coming to terms with Senator John McCain's brain cancer diagnosis. Joining us now is NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Hi, Ron.
Good to be with you, Lisa.
This morning, Senator McCain tweeted, "I greatly appreciate the outpouring of support. Unfortunately for my sparring partners in Congress, I'll be back soon, so stand by." It's clearly a very difficult diagnosis, tragic news, and it's one that Senate Republicans have to consider in many ways, including in what it means politically for them and their effort to pass the health care bill. They were hoping for John McCain's support. How is this diagnosis changing the shape of things in the Senate?
It is a tough diagnosis, but John McCain is a tough guy, and he wants to come back. Whatever the rest of his future may include, he wants to come back to the Senate. He wants to see his colleagues. He wants to be part of the big debates of the day, and he surely has been part of the big debates of the day. So right now, what it does, because he has not resigned, of course, and that means that he's still part of the 100-member Senate, he takes one vote away from Mitch McConnell if he can't be there. That means, because he has, generally speaking, not opposed the health care legislation, he hasn't been a big backer running around talking about it a lot, but he has not been one of the holdouts or one of the people declaring that he would vote against the health care legislation. So we are assuming that his absence actually weakens the position of Senate Majority Mitch McConnell until John McCain can return, and we hope that, of course, can be soon.
And what's ahead for the Senate? If they go ahead with a vote next week, first off, does that look likely? And secondly, what are they going to be voting on?
The president is demanding that they vote next week, and there are many people around the country who are supporters of the president and supporters of the Republican Party. Many of them are donors to the Republican Party, and many of them are demanding that the Senate vote next week on at least one of the options they have before them, one of which would be a straight repeal, a just let's get rid of Obamacare and we won't worry about replacing it just now. We'll work on that some more down the road. That is one option, and they could introduce that and vote on it. It would be essentially the bill they passed in 2015 as a Republican Senate, but which was vetoed by President Obama. The other option would be to sub in this bill that they are still tweaking, still evolving. We've called it Better Care Reconciliation Act, BCRA, and then there was 2.0 of that, and now we have 3.0 of that with a few more tweaks. They could take the CBO score they have of that, which shows something like 22 million people losing their insurance, and they could take that to the floor and have that vote. We do not yet know which they exactly will choose to vote on.
Ron Elving, you have such a good read on Congress. I wonder, as you look at moderate Republicans who are among the senators who held up the health care legislation this week, are they feeling more empowered now? Do they feel more cohesive? And I know they're in small numbers.
They are a handful, and they certainly are feeling more noticed, and they certainly are feeling more power in that sense, but they are also under an enormous amount of pressure. The simplest way of putting it is, this was your party's main promise for 7 years. How can you possibly stand in the way of at least bringing it to the floor of the Senate to be debated and amended? That's a very tough thing for them to answer, but their answer has been, we don't see any point in bringing to the floor and amending a bill we know we have to vote against because it's so bad for our constituents. They have their voters to be concerned about as well.
Do they have any staying power? I mean, moving toward, say, tax reform or other issues?
My guess would be that if they can get past this one way or another, either get Obamacare repealed or get some sort of a replacement bill passed and signed by the president, either way, that would be a great momentum towards going towards tax reform. But if they cannot do that and have to set it aside, That takes a lot of air out of the room, and then they're going to go on recess in August. They're going to come back in the fall. They're going to have to be completely focused on the fiscal problems they're leaving behind, essentially the failure to pass the spending bills to keep the federal government operating. We risk a shutdown in September, and also the raising of the federal debt ceiling. We're already past it. We're using extraordinary means at the Treasury Department to continue paying the government's bills. They have to deal with that also before the end of September. So then maybe they could turn to tax reform and try to build back some momentum towards actually doing that heavy lift.
Good to talk to you. Ron Elving, NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent. Thanks as always.
Thank you, Lisa.
Well, in parts of the country, oil drilling and production is on the upswing. In the Permian Basin of West Texas, output has doubled over the past 5 years. The region now produces a quarter of the country's daily oil supply. But the boom in Texas has a byproduct. Producers are less excited about this. It's oil theft. The Houston-based Energy Security Council estimates that this year alone, Texas companies will lose between $450 million and nearly $1.5 billion at today's prices in stolen oil. Marfa Public Radio's Sally Bove has the story.
Fred Weiss owns a new and used oil field equipment business in Odessa, Texas.
We just have several rigs in the yard.
He sells everything, from whole electric drilling rigs all the way down to their bits and pieces.
We have 3,000 horsepower, 2,000, 1,500, 1,000 horsepower. Just we've got a lot of rigs that are for sale, you know.
In the middle of our interview, he's getting cold calls from oil field security companies trying to sell him software and cameras. Weiss was recently robbed.
This is where they got me the other day. So
he walks me over to a generator lined with caution tape in his dusty storage yard. From the outside, the generator looks like a shipping container. Inside, there's an engine with a tangle of cables hanging from the ceiling.
You can see what's left of the generators that they took the copper out of. Hope we catch them.
Oilfield security is big business in the Permian Basin, and not just in the private sector. There's an FBI-led task force, headquartered in the city of Midland, solely dedicated to investigating cases of oilfield theft. Special Agent Andrea Simmons coordinates the task force from the sixth floor of a downtown plaza building. Oil and gas infrastructure is visible on the horizon out the office window.
You're always going to have theft. It doesn't matter whether things are booming or not.
Copper stealing has been a problem since the task force began in 2008. But more recently, a rash of oil thefts has become a bigger issue. And disappearing oil is harder to track than materials or equipment.
When there's a boom, the oil companies are so busy, there's so much going on, so much inventory going in and out, that they don't always observe the losses as quickly as they do in a downturn.
Over the span of 1 month this past spring, companies in Midland and Reeves counties in West Texas reported more than 3,200 barrels of oil stolen, worth around $160,000. That's compared to zero reports of oil theft to the FBI office in the year leading up to the spike.
So these are the areas I'll sit out at night and watch. There's a snake right there, rattlesnake.
Midland County Sergeant John Henry is a member of the task force. We drive on a dirt road to a site with a pump jack and a couple of tank batteries, which store the oil being pumped out of a nearby well.
I'm going to tell you right now, oil thefts has happened at this one. I'm not sure when it was, but I remember this lease.
Henry says this last spike of oil thefts was the most significant he's seen since joining the task force nearly 5 years ago. That makes him think the incidents were related and well organized. Here's how it often works. Oil truck drivers attach a load line, which is basically a hose, to the tank battery and suck out up to 200 barrels of oil. They store it elsewhere and eventually get the oil back into the pipeline system and registered with Texas oil regulators at the Railroad Commission. That makes the oil legitimate.
That's money in their pocket. They get a barrel of oil. That's $50.
Another way of making black market crude legitimate again is by bringing it to a wastewater disposal service. It's legal for wastewater operators to sell the oil they've skimmed off the top. But some operators that steal oil will shuffle their paperwork and mix stolen oil into the skim for a bigger profit. Sergeant Henry says that petroleum theft is really difficult to prove. The task force has 10 open investigations going, but the last successful prosecution in the area was in early 2015.
Law enforcement can't be everywhere. They can't put cameras everywhere. It's such a wide area. I think Midland is 960 square miles, you know, and a lot of that is oil field.
Witnesses are hard to come by in oil theft investigations, so getting folks who are in on the scheme to talk is key. A bill recently passed by Texas lawmakers to increase penalties might make that easier. The hope is felony charges will spur more plea deals and cooperation from insiders. And while major oil companies might not suffer much from tens of thousands of dollars in oil stolen here, or copper wire or a generator stolen there, it's the smaller producers and business owners like Fred Weiss back in Odessa who feel every penny.
You never get used to it, no, and it does hurt.
For Here and Now, I'm Sally Bovee in Midland, Texas.
A major change in arms policy is underway in Washington. The CIA will no longer provide weapons to help rebel groups in Syria fight the Assad government. The Washington Post was the first to report the decision that the Trump administration decided to halt a program that started with President Obama in 2013. Aaron David Miller is vice president for new initiatives at the Wilson Center. He's a former advisor to Republican and Democratic administrations and joins us from Washington. Welcome back, Aaron.
Always a pleasure.
In your view, is this a wise move or not to stop arming the rebels fighting President Assad?
I mean, I think it's a question of diminishing returns and a change in administrations. The decision was probably taken a month ago, but I think the arc and the trajectory has been running against the opposition and our support for it for a number of years, certainly beginning with the Russian intervention in Syria in the fall of 2015. And I think the onset of the Trump administration, whose public and clearly private approach to dealing with this with Syria is to focus primarily on the Islamic State and to see if they can't reach some modus vivendi with the Russians. It was a clear natural progression, which probably followed the G20 and the ceasefire arrangement in southwestern Syria with the Russians. So I think this was more or less, frankly, inevitable.
Inevitable, meaning what kind of difference might it make on the ground? If it was so inevitable, was it expected on the ground, and what would matter?
Well, it's going to clearly deny the United States probably access to a group of fighters who have proven themselves to be among most effective. But a CIA study, which was put on Obama's desk, I think as early as 2012, 2013, made it unmistakably clear that external support for these sorts of groups during the course of a civil war usually does not work. And I think this program and the Obama administration's slow response to recognize or want to create a greater military presence on the ground it has simply been reinforced by the Trump administration. There's absolutely no desire in this administration, it seems to me, to militarize the American role in Syria beyond what the administration considers its core vital interest, which is eliminating the Islamic State caliphate and dealing with some of the other jihadi groups. So again, inevitable in the sense that ultimately with the support for the Syrian regime growing, Assad's consolidation of power over central Syria, Iranian and Russian support for the regime, the kinds of efforts the agency was making or would make simply paled in comparison to what would have been required to check both Syrian, Iranian and Russian influence on the ground.
So I want to push on with what the U.S. presence is in Syria right now. But why wouldn't something like this work? I mean, is it you're saying that the United States did not invest enough in the effort?
Well, you know, if the Obama administration, remember, in all fairness to this administration, it inherited an extremely fraught situation in Syria. Had the president of the United States, Barack Obama, that is, said in 2012, Syria is going to be a major priority for my administration. It is going to be the most important priority, and I'm going to develop a comprehensive political, economic, and military strategy to deal with the Syrian civil war. I'm going to come up with a comprehensive military approach, literally to effectively undermine the Assad regime, seek its removal. The problem is nobody in the Obama administration and nobody in the Trump administration, even those hawks like Dave Petraeus and Hillary Clinton, who advised early on to do more to arm and to cultivate relations with the opposition, was prepared in the end, to get stuck with a check for Syria. And you now find with an America First president, quote unquote, a greater reluctance and more of a willingness to cede influence to others. We at the moment are Russia's junior partner in Syria.
Are we partners? I mean, do we have the same goals?
Well, I think the answer to that is no. But the Russians have clearly been willing to assert and project their military power. The Iranians most certainly are. For them, Iraq and Syria are vital. We're simply, and we say we, I'm talking about the Congress and most of the American public, is simply not prepared to invest what would be required in terms of deployment of forces on the ground and money and credibility to engage in a major leadership role in Syria. And I think that was recognized even by the Obama administration and clearly has been validated as U.S. policy in the Trump administration.
What is the best hope for attaining some kind of peace in Syria right now, with or without U.S. help? Very briefly.
I mean, the academics would tell you that in these sorts of confrontation and civil wars, they usually last a decade. And we're now in
more than 5 years.
Right. We're now, 2011, 2012. So we're now into the sixth year, basically. I think that the future of Syria as a coherent, cohesive polity with a central government that controls its borders, that somehow guarantees security and a modicum of prosperity for its citizens, a degree of accountability and confessional balance that addresses Sunni grievances on which the Islamic State and the other jihadis feed. I think the prospects for that, frankly, are slim to none.
Aaron David Miller at the Wilson Center, thanks again.
Thank you, Lisa.
Some U.S. military veterans rely on the help of a service dog. The dog helps a veteran with visual or hearing problems or mobility issues. The Department of Veterans Affairs helps pay for it. But if a vet needs a service dog to help cope with post-traumatic stress disorder, the government won't pay. And that policy is getting some pushback. Paige Flager reports from Long Island, New York.
Russell Kaiser lives in a housing complex for veterans in Ronkonkoma, Long Island, with his service dog, Artemis. Artemis kind of looks like a German shepherd, but sleeker, with amber-colored eyes that follow Kaiser as he walks around the room. Kaiser developed post-traumatic stress disorder after serving in the Army in Kosovo in 2004.
At the worst, I would only sleep maybe 2 or 3 hours a night. When I did sleep, the dreams were like I was in a state of pure terror. It was like closing my eyes and going into a horror movie.
He was willing to try pretty much anything to make the PTSD go away. Then he heard about a program called Paws of War. They take dogs from shelters and train them to be service animals for veterans across the country, free of charge.
Artemis in.
If Artemis senses that Kaiser's on edge, she'll position herself to block him from people who might startle him.
For the anxiety level, she starts biting my hand, like a nibble. That's how she does it. And the nightmare, she's waking, licks my face. And also, when she jumps up and grabs me, that's the cue to remove myself from a place because I'm being overwhelmed. She'll know it before I do.
Having a service dog or emotional support dog, or even a companion animal, is one tool in their recovery from their wounds of war, whether they're physical or hidden wounds.
That's Tori Schofield, one of the founders of Paws of War, and her involvement doesn't end when a dog goes home with a veteran.
I help them if they need yearly vaccines. We give them at-cost heartworm preventative. So anything else that I can do above and beyond to help defray costs for them will do.
The Department of Veterans Affairs pays for veterinary costs for service dogs for veterans with visual, hearing, or mobility disorders, including equipment like harnesses or backpacks, as well as medical and dental procedures and prescribed medications. But the VA won't foot the veterinary bill for service dogs for veterans with PTSD, and that just doesn't add up to Schofield.
It's just as debilitating and crippling as any other physical disability. You just don't see it. We hope that in the future, not too distant future, that the VA will provide these services.
The VA is waiting on hard evidence that the service dogs really help veterans cope with PTSD. Michael Fallon is the VA's chief veterinary medicine doctor.
I would say there are a lot of heartwarming stories that suggest that service dogs might help people with PTSD, but the scientific basis for that claim is lacking.
The VA started a study back in 2011, but had trouble with ill-trained dogs. Some of them even bit children. So that study was called off.
The VA is primarily based upon evidence-based medicine, and we certainly would want people to utilize a therapy that has proven value.
Sit. Yes. Stop swearing.
For Russell Kaiser, Artemis has already proven more than valuable.
How it works, I don't know. I don't care. I don't try to figure it out. You know, like, I know antibiotics work, too. I don't need to go through the chemical breakdown of it, you know? Like, it just works.
A new study is underway. The VA is now recruiting veterans to participate, but it isn't expected to be finished before 2019. So, at least until then, the government has no plans to cover veterinary care for PTSD service dogs. For Here and Now, I'm Paige Flager.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started. Started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
New research from the Federal Reserve of New York sheds light on just how much student debt may be preventing millennials from buying homes. Now, we've talked about this anecdotally. This new study finds that there's been a dip in home ownership among 28 to 30-year-olds, and as much as 35% of that drop is directly related to student loan debt. Lynette Lopez is senior finance correspondent for Business Insider. She joins us from New York. And Lynette, the study looked at how many millennials would own homes if tuition at public colleges had stayed at 2001 levels. What did it find?
It found that 360,000 more millennials would own homes in 2015. That's quite a number, and all of these numbers are pretty stunning. There's been a 68% increase in the student debt that a 25-year-old is holding from 2003 to 2011. There's been an 81% increase in college, state college, public tuition from 2001 to 2009, and 174% more student. There's more student debt exists in this world since 2003. So we're looking at just massive amounts of debt being taken on. And if you listen to people that have been talking about this issue for years, they say it goes back to the 1980s. King Alexander, the president of the Louisiana State University System, in 2015 testified before Congress that the single biggest reason that this is happening and that tuitions are increasing so fast is because states abdicated their responsibility to pay their share for college tuition starting in the 80s. Mm. And funding has just been going down ever since then.
Well, people who buy homes also end up spending money on things they need in their homes, like furniture. So is there a larger economic impact if millennials are not buying homes, which this study says they're not?
Sure. I get, 70% of American spending is consumer spending,
buying
household spending,
trapper
keeper, filling your car with gas and, doing things to start a family. If you can't own a home, a lot of people start families later. And the one thing that this noted was that there's 36% less credit card debt among those with student loans. So instead of having credit card debt, instead of buying things that, then pay someone else in the economy, this money is going to student debt. It's just falling down into a hole. And a lot of that, is interest.
Well, especially when it comes to public schools, is there a secondary message here? Don't raise your tuitions because you're going to get an economic hit in other ways in where your school's located.
Sure. And I think there's definitely states need to look and say, you know, this is going to start to affect our tax dollars because, you know, we're not going to have people buying things as much as they are. They would normally. And the Obama administration was kind of slow to get on board with this concept. They kind of denied that there was any problem. And they said that the benefits of giving people this education far outweighed any issues there would be with consumer spending. And now we're finding that's probably not the case.
Yeah. Lynette Lopez, senior finance correspondent for Business Insider. New study showing millennials are, you know, not buying homes because they can't afford it because of their college tuition. Lynette, thank you.
Have a good one.
You too. Members of the media are gathered at the Lovelock Correctional Facility and at the parole board in nearby Carson City, Nevada, for today's two-location parole hearing for O.J. Simpson. Simpson, the former football star, first fell from grace in 1994 when he was accused of killing his ex-wife and her friend. He was acquitted in that trial, which was watched around the world. He's currently serving a 9-to-33-year sentence for armed robbery and kidnapping, a botched attempt to get back his memorabilia. He was convicted in 2008. If parole, he could be released as soon as October 1st. Simpson has been speaking for a while now, the parole hearing going on right now. He's explaining the botched robbery and his bad judgment. Here's a bit of what he's saying.
You know, there's nothing I can do about this kind of media circus that's going on right now, but I could do something about the whole thing in the beginning. If I would have made a better judgment back then, none of this would have happened. And I take full responsibility.
Sean Whaley is the Capitol Bureau reporter for the Las Vegas Review-Journal in Carson City. Sean, what's been the scene there today?
Well, we've certainly had a lot of media interest, to put it mildly. There's more than 30 news organizations here in Carson City, satellite trucks, all the accoutrements that come along with a big story. O.J. Simpson's big news still for a lot of people around the world. Kind of unusual for little Carson City to have this kind of attention.
Well, remind us of the circumstances of this particular arrest. O.J. Simpson was involved in an armed robbery, but even the judge at the time said he wasn't the one holding the weapons. And he and his friends were trying to steal, he would say, take back his own sports memorabilia?
Yeah, this happened in 2007 in Las Vegas. Mr. Simpson was attending a wedding in Las Vegas. A friend of his said, hey, this gentleman who has some of your memorabilia is in town, let's go over and get it back. So Simpson and some friends go over to the Palace Station Hotel in Las Vegas, meet with these gentlemen, and one of the people with Simpson has a gun. They take the memorabilia back from these two individuals, and as a result of that, he was charged with robbery and kidnapping and other assault charges and so on. And so he was convicted of multiple charges, sent to prison, and he's been at Lovelock since 2009.
Well, look, he got a longer sentence than the one actually holding the gun. Is there a sense still that this was sort of payback for being acquitted in the murder trial of his wife and her friend? He did lose a civil trial, but is there some sense that this was there's a little payback here?
I think a lot of people believe that to be true. I think if you ask the judge or the other people involved in the crime, they would say no. But public opinion, I believe, is that Mr. Simpson, because he was not convicted of the crimes in California, that there was some level of payback for being convicted of the charges in Nevada. Mm-hmm. I don't think anyone would ever admit to that. Mm-hmm. I don't know what's in the mind of the prosecutor in Clark County who charged him and tried him and convicted him. But there's certainly public view that that could be the case.
What about the sense of his chance of parole? That we know that there's a scale that takes a lot of things into consideration, the age of the inmate. It's not completely subjective. People have been looking at that scale. What's the sense that he might be paroled?
Right. There's a number of things they look at. The level of the seriousness of the crime, past criminal history, which he doesn't really have any, his age, his plan for what he's going to do upon release. And so it's not totally subjective. The four members of the parole board that will hear his case today have a assessment of him. But generally, the belief is that he's been a very good inmate in the prison system. He has been a role model. He has been following the rules, not getting into trouble, trying to be somewhat of a, you know, help to other inmates, and that was described in his first parole hearing back in 2013. I haven't heard anything to the contrary since then, although we'll get more details today.
Sean Wally, Capital Bureau reporter for the Las Vegas Review-Journal in Carson City, Nevada. Sean, thank you.
You're welcome.
Google Glass is back. Maybe you remember it. It looked like an almost empty eyeglass frame. If you wore one, you could see digital information beam from a smartphone to a small glass tab. The tab sat right in front of one eye. The prototype was released in 2013, and it was the technology of the future until it wasn't. After criticism and safety concerns, Google, now called Alphabet, officially stopped producing the prototype in 2015. That was then. Now it turns out that Google's Moonshot Division X is bringing the technology back to life. Stephen Levy got a look inside for Back Channel, the weekly digital magazine published by Wired. Hi, Stephen.
Thanks.
Remind us why Google Glass was such a big fail the first time around.
Well, it was launched with incredible fanfare. It was the star of the big conference they did in 2012 where skydivers jumped out of a plane and you saw the fall from their point of view. What the main purpose of it was, basically people used it to, instead of staring at their phone, they would stare at this little screen suspended above their eye. And then what probably killed it was that people started getting angry when they saw people wearing the thing because it could record video, but you didn't know when it was recording video. And people thought that they were being taped surreptitiously by these wearers. And they even had a term for the wearers, which I'm not going to repeat because it's a bad word that begins with a G.
Ends with an E, kind of two words together. So it lasted about 2 years on the market, was a dramatic failure, and now what's changed?
What happened was that while Google Glass was a failure, Google and X Division started hearing about some customers that were finding a real use for it. And these were customers in the workplace, in factories and warehouses that could find that instead of replacing a phone, the information they got from Glass replaced the process where they'd have to look at a computer or a big, thick manual to get the instructions from their work and interrupt the workflow. And as they thought about it more, they thought maybe we should develop a new version of Glass that's optimized for these people in workplace situations. And that's why we have now something called Glass Enterprise Edition. The places have been using it, like Volkswagen and GE and Boeing, are all reporting positive results, and they're moving from test to production.
So it's mostly industries. Tell us how it's used, like how a typical factory worker might be able to use it and where.
Well, I actually visited a factory that's using it in Jackson, Minnesota, which is in southwest Minnesota. And it was fascinating because this place built tractors, and each worker has a workstation and does an operation that's maybe an hour, 70 minutes long, broken up into steps. And for each step, they say, okay, Glass, proceed, and it'll tell them what the next step is. So if this is second nature to the worker doesn't have to look at the screen too much. But these tractors, as I learned, often have very custom features, and when a customer orders it. So you might see, if you're putting together a motor, a picture of the motor with lit up the little places where you would put the bolts in. And then you would see a menu saying, I'm done this. Or if you have a problem, you could say, maybe this part is damaged. You could take a picture of it, and someone, will take a look and say, wow, you're right, we have to send that back. Or why don't you just try this? So you can get real-time assistance while you're on the work line.
Is there anything worrisome about that? I guess these factory workers would be looking at a computer if they weren't looking through this glass, but does it lead to less problem-solving on their own or less reliance on their own memory?
Well, it's still part of the problem-solving process. I think that if there is a concern from the worker's point of view, this is something that actually logs what you do step by step. And so in some cases, this could be a positive thing for them. If they're falling behind and someone else is ahead, they could be flagged and saying, hey, help that person in station 50. On the other hand, they could say, you know what, you're not doing a very good job.
Yeah, they're keeping very close watch of what you're doing. How likely do you think it is that this new life for Google Glass in industry might give new life to the old Google Glass in everyday life?
Well, that's something I try to explore with Alphabet in saying what is the prospects for the consumer version. And they really didn't want to talk to it. I think there's still a little snake bit about that. But I actually asked some of the people who are using it in the enterprise whether they might want to use this at home. And some of them were a little reluctant, but one guy finally said, well, gee, maybe I could do it and answer my email while I'm doing the dishes.
Why not? Why do one thing when you can do two or three? Stephen Levy, editor of Back Channel, a digital magazine published by Wired. Nice to speak with you.
Great talking to you, Lisa.
Is there anything better on a summer day than a handful of fresh-picked berries? Well, maybe not, but here now, resident chef Kathy Gunst is going to do her darndest to find something that is equally good using berries. She's in the studio with us. Hi, Kathy.
Hello.
And Lisa and I have just these wonderful things spread out in front of us.
And we haven't touched it. At least I haven't.
Some of you haven't. Yeah. Robin has a little issue.
Yeah, I do. But there are so many wonderful berries available now.
There are, and this is the season. I actually woke up early this morning, and I live in southern Maine, and I picked these raspberries that are everywhere this morning. It's beautiful. A great year for it. But you said it. I mean, there is nothing more festive than a pile of pink and red and black and blue berries. Mm-hmm. You just put them with a dollop of yogurt for breakfast or eat them on top of a piece of cake or a biscuit. And it's suddenly life feels festive. There's just something about them that makes you happy. But plus, they taste great.
Well, and you can make them into jam and put them on toast. Listen.
Yeah. Nice crunch there. I know. So let me tell you about that jam. That I know your first thought is like, right, like I have time to make jam, but you do. All you do is take 5 cups of berries, whether it's strawberries and raspberries like I did. You could add blackberry, blueberries. Mm. I added not a ton of sugar, 1/2 cup of sugar plus 3 tablespoons, but then I add grated lemon zest and lemon juice because that is where the pectin comes in, mm-hmm. and that causes it to thicken. The whole jam, ready? 45 minutes, the whole thing.
Wow.
And you can make a huge batch and can it for all winter or make a small batch.
And the toast gone in 30 seconds.
The toast will not last that long.
And I thought actually for jam that you had to have a fair amount of sugar. I mean, you're not a big sugar user and here.
Yeah, I try to use as little as possible. You need a certain amount of sugar to make the jam gel. So I might have even reduced it more, but I knew that I needed. But when you eat that jam, hopefully what you taste is fresh summer berries. Berries, not sugar, as you do with so many commercially produced jams and jellies.
So you have also here next to the jam and the toast, which we heard Robin eating, and she still is. It's gone now. A berry tart or a galette?
A galette, which is a rustic French style tart. It's also sometimes called a crostata, and those are local strawberries, finished in many parts of the country, but they're coming down from Canada now. And to me, a local strawberry, maybe because it's such a short season, is just such a huge treat. So all I did was mix fresh strawberries, again, a touch of sugar, roll out this pastry, which I will admit has quite a bit of butter in it.
Well, I was just going to ask, what's the difference between a pie and a tart?
Well, a pie is in a more traditional shape. It's actually in a pie plate, mm-hmm. and it either has lattice on top or an upper crust. This is freeform. You roll out a 12-inch circle. You pile the fruit in. You pull the flaps of the galette over it, not mm-hmm. completely. I love to make this and teach people how to do this, people who are scared of making pies.
Because it's not that complicated.
It's really easy. And you know what? It's really hard to screw up because it's freeform. Well, Robin, you know what? You just eat it and enjoy it, okay?
You said it is really buttery. Is that,
Yes. That is the truth. So not a lot of sugar, but you could add less butter to the pastry. But it is a super rich, buttery pastry, which, just plays off of that sweet, sweet strawberry juice. And you could make that with blackberries. You could make it with huckleberries. You could make it with a combination of boysenberries and blackberries. Mm-hmm. Really, any berries that you have access to at a farmer's market or in the wild. I mean, going to pick blueberries and strawberries and raspberries in the summer is the stuff of children's literature.
Right.
It's how I got my kids to love eating berries.
Okay, you also have muffins. We can't leave out muffins.
Can't forget those. Yes. Those are...
Speak to us of blueberry butter.
Oh, yes. Let's not forget that. We have raspberry ginger muffins, adorable little muffins. Mm. And then this is, I thought, oh, it needs a little something. So I mashed 4 blackberries and 4 raspberries with a fork. Just mash them up so they get juicy and thin. And then I added 3 tablespoons of very room temperature butter to it. Mm. Spread a little of that on the raspberry ginger muffin, and you are in a very, very good place.
How to get in there somewhere.
Yeah, sorry.
So talk about keeping berries. I have all these great intentions, and then a day later they're moldy. Talk about keeping them.
Well, best thing, again, would be to go picking them. But if you're buying them, buy them from someone that picked them that morning. If the basket that it's in, you know, they often come in those cardboard berry things. If it's wet, don't buy them. Mm-hmm. If they look mushy and they're not holding their shape, do not buy them. You want berries that are holding their shape, that are not blemished or bruised. And if you're not going to use them right away, put them on a cookie sheet, put them in the freezer for an hour, and then throw them into a Ziploc bag. Mm. That pre-freezing will keep them separate and they won't all clump up. Pull them out in February and you'll be very happy.
Okay. It will not take their ester out.
No.
Julia Child once told me, do not put a tomato in the refrigerator.
I agree.
Ester.
The ester, yes.
Summer berries. Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunz. Of course, we'll have all her recipes at hereandnow.org. Kathy, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy.
And a choir sings. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Lisa Mullins. In appreciation for Jeremy Hobson for letting me fill in on a Kathy Gunz
day.
This is Here and Now.